Good morning, diners and travelers. Welcome to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and welcome to a continuing discussion about Italian cuisine.
Yeah, it's if you ever wanted to test whether or not Italian is most people's favorite cuisine around the world, all you have to do is look at all the cookbooks that we get.
Oh, yes.
Based on Italian food, and even though we did some in November and later, again, when we got back from Sicily, we're nevertheless compelled to do so again because we have three absolutely extraordinarily brilliant books about the cooking of Italy, and perhaps the most brilliant, although it's tough to draw comparisons, is our good friend Coleman Andrews, who told us some months ago when he talked about country cooking of Ireland that that was a trial run for country cooking of Italy, and now the real thing is out, and it's a beauty. Now, so let's hear what Coleman had to say about it.
Coleman Andrews has so many credentials that if we went through them all, we'd use up the whole interview time. It's good talking to you again, Coleman.
Oh, likewise. Pleasure to be here.
And I love this book. I told you that before. I guess the first question is, exactly as you indicated, why another book on Italian cooking? But this one's different. It's called The Country Cooking of Italy. And you have an introduction or foreword by Mario Batali, who seems to be the designated forward writer for Italian cookbooks. This is a different book. And maybe you could, well, first of all, it's a very large book.
Right.
And I think, let's start where you start, is you first set out to define what country cooking in Italy was and what it was not. So there are things that people immediately notice are not in this.
Right. The first filter I used was just to say dishes which are strongly associated with cities. Risotto Milanese from Milan, Fettuccine Alfredo from Rome, even Pizza Napolitana from Naples. Those I left out. I went to smaller cities, I would say provincial cities, farm towns and villages, and really looked for the food there. And the obvious reason is that in any big city, you tend to have much more of a mixture of different kinds of food, and good food from different parts of the countryside, even in America, would end up maybe in a restaurant in New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco or something. So that's fine, and there's plenty of very, very good food in the cities of Italy. But I wanted to go out and find some of the dishes that hadn't made their way back into the mainstream of Italian cooking.
I was raised in an Italian family, a Sicilian family specifically,
right.
And I have been going back and forth to Italy since I went to school in Florence. And I think I know a lot about Italian cooking. And I'll tell you dishes in this book that I've never heard of. Not even vaguely heard of.
There are dishes in this book I've never heard of. one of the things I did when I started going around, and of course, I hasten to add, there are familiar dishes in here.
Oh, sure.
But with recipes that tend to be, in most cases, simpler and more straightforward than what we know, eggplant alla parmigiana or chicken alla cacciatore, things like that. But as I wandered around Italy, and as I said, somebody asked me how long it took me to research this book, and I said about 40 years.
Uh-huh.
I've been... which is as long as I've been going to Italy back and forth, and I noticed all along I've noticed, and then more recently when I made some trips to spend a little more time in areas that I hadn't been to as much, like Sicily and Basilicata and Puglia, when you go to small towns especially, you find dishes that you've just never heard of, no matter how much you think you know about Italian food. And I dare say if you were a Tuscan or a Venetian or a Roman, you would find, you'd walk into some of these restaurants and not understand what half of the stuff on the menu was, because it is so regional, and I just thought there was such a wealth of great food that we just don't get here, and we just don't get if we go to the main cities of Italy.
Someone recently we interviewed, Coleman, said there's really no such thing as Italian cooking because it's all regional, and I'm guessing that you would say in spades.
It's very important to remember that Italy didn't exist until 1861.
Right, right.
When the country was unified, and there are people that still think it was a mistake. Of course, we all know, for instance, Venice was a republic, and Genoa was a republic, and Vatican City was a strong political power in the middle of Rome, and we know about those, but there are small towns that are insignificant today. You'd hardly even know they were there that were their own states and their own city-states. Or in Liguria, where I did a book some years ago, I've forgotten the name of the town, but there was a town that you've never heard of, I'd never heard of, that printed its own money at one point and collected tolls for people that came through the Alps to trade routes further south. And so there's this tremendous sense of identity that's very localized. It's not even regional so much as identification with an individual town
or a family.
Or a family, yeah, exactly right. And you don't really hear people say very often, I'm a Friulian, I'm a, you might hear a Tuscan, but in general, you know, I'm an Emilian or Romagnan or I'm a Ligurian. They don't say that. They say I'm Genovese. They say they name the town, they name the city. And that's where their loyalties lie. And I think that's one of the things that has kept the richness of the food so incredible.
Coleman, you've forgotten the period 2,000 years ago when the Roman Empire, I guess, controlled the whole of Italy.
Well, that's true, but they were only one of the people that, one of the peoples, let's say, that has controlled various parts of Italy, as you know. And if you look even today, part of Italy, way up in the far northwestern corner in the Valle d'Aosta, is basically French-speaking, French-influenced. Then in Chino Alto Adige, It's an area that was part of Austria. So it's German-speaking. Friuli, it's Slovenian heavy influence. And even places that don't touch, there, as you know, in Sicily, there's a heavy Moorish influence. In parts of Basilicata and Puglia, there are villages where people still speak Greek because Greeks fled across the Adriatic at various periods for economic or social reasons and established themselves there. So really there's, and the Spanish, the Catalan and Aragonese were all over Naples and Sardinia, and there's a town, Alghero in Sardinia, which you still see street signs in Catalan. So there's all of these influences from different places.
Well, now, let's go back to first principles then. This is a book, a masterpiece of research, but how did you expect that people would use it? Did you have some particular ideas in mind about why the book would be particularly useful?
Well, I have a philosophy that's something that my very first cookbook, published in 1988, which was Catalan Cuisine, just seemed like a good idea to me then, and Savera Magazine, which I co-founded. These are things based on the belief that if you know more about food than just the measurements and the recipe, if you know something about the people who invented a dish or the area of the world where it was invented or the conditions under which it was invented, that if you know all this context, that first of all, it definitely, I think, makes it more enjoyable to eat the dish because you're not just eating a bunch of flavors, you're eating a history or a story. But more than that, I honestly believe it makes it easier to cook it in the original spirit of the dish if you understand why it was cooked that way originally.
And my Nona would love you because she never measured anything either.
Oh, sure. I mean, as I say in my introduction, I've never measured olive oil by the tablespoon in my life, and I doubt that any Italian has.
This is true, because I've never baked with olive oil, so I've never baked.
Well, no, baking is another thing. There you have to be more precise.
You do have a very loose approach to quantities here, and you have to use what you said is common sense. It's what my grandmother used to always say, is, you know, she thought I was retarded when I wanted minutes for this and tablespoons for that.
Well, I have to say I do in all my recipes give the minutes and the tablespoons.
Oh, sure.
But it's like, you know, if you do a map quest search for something, there's always a little disclaimer that says, you know, this is more or less accurate, but you may, you know, check for construction and one-way streets and things like that. And it's kind of like that with recipes. I mean, give you the guidelines so that you know that we're talking about 6 tablespoons of olive oil and not 3 gallons of olive oil. But beyond that, is it 5 tablespoons or 7 tablespoons or whatever? It probably doesn't matter a whole lot in most cases.
Well, I think that people are going to enjoy the recipes here because it's really delicious food. It's the food of the poor, povera, but they went for whatever they had, bring the most flavor to it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and you have unusual things that most people who are only exposed to things like spaghetti and meatballs are going to be surprised, like giotta with the bean and sauerkraut soup.
Yeah, hearty soup from Friuli. Really wonderful winter soup. I think even pastas. I have a recipe which I found in Liguria when I was researching my book there, for instance, which is penne pasta that is not cooked in water. It's cooked directly in white wine. Boil the wine down, and by the time the wine just about evaporates, coating all the pasta with this kind of glaze, slightly sweet glaze, the pasta is cooked. And you toss it with some olive oil and Parmigiano, and it's just the most incredible thing you've ever had.
And yeah, I made a mental note to do that. I'm going to make that one. Yeah, I don't make a whole lot of pasta because we it's so good, you know, it's a calorie thing.
Oh, yeah, I know.
But you devote, like, you have not just pasta section. You have pasta secca, pasta fresca. Right. Then you have a separate thing of rice, polenta, and grains. Of course, then you have the bread. You have the seafood. You have the
It's the low-carb diet cookbook, or the gluten-free cookbook, I'm afraid.
No. And then you have an offal. You have game. I mean, there's so much in here. Of all these things, because you've been, as you said, 40 years back and forth to Italy, what new discovery, what dish really blew your mind because it was something you'd never had?
I think one of the most unusual and dramatic dishes that I discovered, and this is a Sicilian dish, but really not very well known even in Sicily, is something with the curious dialect name of ripido nevicato, and it's from Catania in Sicily. And ripido is more or less volcanic ash. As you know, Sicily is a volcanic island,
right?
And nevicato means snow covered or snowy. So the name of the dish is more or less snow falling on volcanic ash, I guess you could say.
Uh-huh.
And what it is, a dish of black risotto, so made with cuttlefish or squid and the ink, so the rice is black. So it's already pretty dramatic looking.
It's actually not very attractive looking. I was looking at
it.
When you finish this, you'll tell us the story about the description of a woman.
I will. And then a very rich, bright red tomato sauce, which is spooned right on the top of it, and that's presumably to imitate the lava in the volcano. And then the really unusual part is, then it is scattered with grated cheese, with grated ricotta cheese, crumbled ricotta cheese. And as you know, the Italians in general never put cheese with seafood in pasta or risotto.
Well, they never put milk with fish, period.
No, exactly.
I thought that my grandmother was maybe even Jewish because she wouldn't have dairy with fish.
That's funny.
Yeah.
No, but you know, how many tourists have sat down in a trattoria in Florence or Rome and ordered spaghetti with clams and then said, can I have some parmigiano with it? And the waiters look at them like they're crazy. But this is a rare instance where they actually put cheese on this. So the overall effect is this ash-covered volcano with the lava down in the middle and snow on top. And it's quite dramatic.
And you had a colloquialism about comment on a woman's appearance.
Oh, yes. There's a contemporary Sicilian novelist named Capellani, Ottavio Capellani, who wrote a book called Sicilian Tragedy. And one of his characters, who is a very unpleasant 70-year-old contessa that sort of lords it over everyone, he said, from the makeup she's wearing, it looks as if she has fallen face down in a plate of ripido nevicato. So you could just picture that,
yes.
the snowy white, the black, and the red. You know
the other thing I thought was fun is you talk about crudo. Now, I mean, first of all, we never had raw fish growing up, I can assure you. And secondly, Peter and I were in World War II. We were in Sicily, weren't we, in Taormina, where they had this trattoria, rabbit, where they came out and asked us if we wanted crudo. And did we eat crudo? And we said yes, and all the Italians in the place, because the rest of them were all Italians, looked at us, you know, as though we were pots Americana.
I don't recall that incident. I do recall that happening in Puglia.
Maybe it's Puglia.
In Puglia, I remember that restaurant we liked so much, we went back there 2 days later. They asked us after we'd had the 14 appetizers on the plate, on the table in front of us, they said, did we eat crudo? And I asked Anne what they were talking about, and she had explained to me that it was raw, and I said, well, I guess why wouldn't we? So we had some raw fish, and then we had some oysters, which were also terrific, and that was before we really started the main course.
Right.
But that was, you said, that was invented by
David
Pasternak.
Or someone, I don't know, someone in New York, because,
what's his name, Cedroni.
Cedroni, right, he's doing it now.
He does it.
Moreno Cedroni near Ancona.
We ate there. He's totally mad, you know.
Oh, he's crazy, yeah.
He's really crazy.
But, you know, that's something that, first time I ever had fresh tuna, because, you know, 30, 40 years ago in America, nobody ate fresh tuna. First time I ever had fresh tuna was in Venice, and it was cooked completely through. There was no hint of red or pink.
Yeah.
It was quite good, but it was certainly not like what we think of as the correct way to cook tuna today. And that's the way Italians cook fish. A friend of mine in Venice said, when he was a kid, they used to eat clams and mussels raw. They were little ones. off the rocks and things. But that's different for to eat raw fish. But now it's gone back to Italy, and now, as you say, you do find it in Italy. The same way that Caesar salad, which, as you know, I'm sure, was invented in that
Mexico.
Little Italian hill town of Tijuana. Now it's very common to find in restaurants in Italy to find Caesar salad, but it has nothing to do with Italy any more than crudo does.
Well, the other thing that was interesting that I observed, and this is not the only example, but the adoption of salmon as a sauce for pasta is something that has probably only really happened since the northern European countries joined the EU. Before that,
I'm sure.
I think because it was a relatively inexpensive and widely available kind of fish.
Mm-hmm.
Where, as you know, sadly, which we found again this time, the indications are that the overfishing of the Mediterranean continues to be even worse. And we did meet some people who are part of the fishing fleet in Mazara del Vallo, and their boats now don't fit into the old harbor because they're now using trawler boats which go out for 8 to 10 days at a time.
That's terrible.
And they're freezing the fish. Bad. They're freezing the fish on board. And only for the last 24 hours before they come into port are they actually loading fish that they're actually going to sell fresh at the port.
That's terrible, yeah.
And what's happened to the fish market is that it's much smaller than it used to be because most of the really fresh stuff is sold by cell phone for the
right.
boat even docks.
Exactly. Things change. I mean, what can you say?
They do. I think something that I found was very interesting in Italy, though, is that this is almost unknown in America, is Italian dishes based on freshwater fish, like lake eel and catfish and trout. There are certain parts of Italy, these are very popular. You almost never find those in an Italian restaurant.
Oh, you mean in the United States? You never.
In the United States, right.
Yeah. Oh, right. You wouldn't, no. I wanted to be assured that all of your recipes are the very best of that particular style of dish. Pappardelle with hare sauce, and I want to eat the page.
That's a dish that I see on menus in America, and nobody makes it with hare sauce because you can't wild hare here. And if you make it with rabbit sauce, it's a little insipid. I mean, I love rabbit, but I wouldn't waste rabbit on a pasta sauce. I'd have it roasted or fried.
Right.
So if you're going to make it, it's worth going to the trouble of ordering wild hare, which you can get periodically through the year from D'Artagnan in New York and a few other mail-order sources. And otherwise, I don't think it's worth making. I'd rather made with pork or beef.
Yeah, I think one of the most disappointing meats, if you like, of the kind that we get here is wild boar, but it's mostly not wild, at least in the United States, whereas in large parts of Italy, I mean, it's on the menu in large parts of Italy, and it's not on the menu at all unless it's wild.
Exactly, and you know, the boar hunt in Maremma in Tuscany, coastal Tuscany, is a big tradition every year.
Yeah, right.
There's different areas, but the problem in the States is that it's illegal to sell for commercial reasons fresh wild game that is truly wild game that has been shot. You can't do it. The closest you can come are in Texas. There's a big ranch that has free-ranging non-indigenous game species, venison and sheep and boar and so forth. That's about the closest you can come. But you can buy now a little bit of imported wild game. It's pretty expensive and you have to mail order it.
Well,
other than that, I'd say, you know, go to Italy and have it there.
Yeah.
Well, I won't tell you where this happened then because I didn't realize what you just told me, because we had venison at a restaurant recently. We were told that it was probably came from the golf course.
Well, okay.
that interview hasn't run yet, and we'll make sure when we do that we don't mention that.
Well, listen, this book is just splendid, and I'm always, every time I see one of your books or any of your projects or talk to you, I'm just amazed at how much you know. It's just what kind of a brain do you have, Coleman Andrews?
I don't know. I think it's all that wine I've been drinking all my life.
But the point that this rigatoni with cauliflower, I mean, that's something else that Sicilians do, is cauliflower. We have a dish we call La Pasta Indiana, and I have no idea. It's one of those family things.
Right.
And it's pasta, and the sauce is you saute fennel fronds, cauliflower, and onions with garlic, and you put it on.
Well, it's from the region of Indiana in Italy.
Exactly.
I mean, you don't know where that is?
It's a sister city of Tijuana.
The interesting thing about that dish and a lot of the pasta dishes from southern Italy is that instead of putting Parmigiano on top, because Parmigiano was expensive and didn't come from the area, so people would put very fine breadcrumbs, seasoned breadcrumbs on top.
And that goes on pasta indiana, too. That goes on pasta indiana, I forgot
about
that.
It tastes great. It's really delicious that way and unusual.
Well, I'm hoping this is the best Ribolletta recipe going, because that's Peter's favorite thing that I never make.
Well, so, you know, Ribolletta, one thing I caution people about is, you make Ribolletta, you have to make it the day ahead reheat it. Otherwise, it's not a Ribolletta. It's not reboiled.
Which I didn't know that that was really what it meant. I didn't even think of that. And you were a true enlightenment about antipasto.
And besides,
I was like everybody else thinking that it meant before pasta.
And don't you have to start with stale bread as well?
Sure.
So you really start the recipe 2 days ago.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. You know, one of my favorites. Speaking of soups, though, one of my favorite recipes, and it was really a revelation when I had this in Puglia, is something called acqua sale, which just means water and salt.
Yeah.
And it's a soup, I guess you could say, except it's ice water in which is floating very thinly sliced onions, little cherry tomatoes, and little thin slices of cucumber with olive oil and salt. And it's so clean and fresh and simple. It's just delicious, but, you know, there's no stock. There's no...
I saw that in here, but I wasn't sure I was all that keen to have it.
It's a cold soup. It's just delicious. It's a perfect summer soup.
Well, of course, Puglia is one of those areas that's been overlooked for ages. I mean,
exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So this is a treasure for this book. Congratulations on yet another winner here.
Thank you very
much. And how's the website going?
Website is great. It's thedailymeal.com, and we're on our way to becoming, I hope, the only website you'll ever need for anything about food and drink. And that doesn't mean everything is on the site, but that if it's not here, we'll take you to it.
Uh-huh.
The ultimate sorting house for clearinghouse for anything you need or want to know.
And well, that's what you
need. We're working on.
I mean, that's what. I said, because I got all these multiple things with repetitions. A clearinghouse is what we need for all things.
Well, that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you for talking to us yet again, Coleman.
Well, thank
Andrews.
You. It's a pleasure, as always.
Yeah, and I look forward to your next project.
Okay, great.
Thanks,
well, thank
Coleman.
You very much.
Bye-bye.
All right.
And we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again. Thank you for standing by. And you're going to be rewarded because in addition to continuing our discussion of everyone's favorite cuisine, we have also one of your favorite, or most people's favorites, chef, Marianne Esposito, who is a television personality, a cookbook writer, and she's the adopted rep of Italian cooking for just about everybody. So Marianne is going to be talking about her book. Let's listen to what she had to say. When I introduced Marianne Esposito, I think that it goes without saying that this woman has lasted and thrived on PBS television for 23 years, Marianne?
That's right. This is our 23rd season.
And I think one reason is that I can honestly say you're the real deal. People trust you.
Well, thank you.
They trust you. I mean, it's that simple. And I think I really have to start by asking, since this is your 12th cookbook, how does it differ from your 11th previous cookbook?
Well, as you know, the subject of Italian food is vast, and this book differs from all the others because it follows the lives, really, of three women who influenced me. I call them three wise women in this book, and they were my two nonas, one from Sicily, Nona Saporito, and then Nona Galasso, who was from around Naples, and my mother. And these three women were all in the food business, and it was the food business that really turned me off as a young girl, a teenager, because I saw how hard these women worked, and of course I was wrangled into helping them as part of the family, and I really said to myself, I never want to do what they're doing. But as you can well imagine, the plums don't fall far from the tree,
right.
So here I am.
But these are amazing women. You say that your mother was not only raising how many kids?
Seven of us.
Seven, and taking care of her mother.
Right.
But in her mid-50s, she set out to get a degree in diet as a dietitian?
That's right. At age 54, my mother announced to the family that she was going to become a dietitian. Now, up until that point, she was a fantastic cook, but I think she really wanted to know the whys and wherefores of dietary nutrition, and she decided she was just going to become a dietitian, and she did. And she still had to wrangle taking care of some of my brothers who were still left at home, and my grandmother, and, of course, take care of my father. So that was quite a feat for a woman of her time.
Oh, sure. And then your two nonas, I mean, wow.
The two nonas really, you know, they were wise because they lived by their wits. I when I say that these were three wise women, I'm not talking about women who had formal educations. I'm talking about two nonas who could not read English, could only speak in their local dialects, and who lived by their wits. And both of them were involved in food. Nona Saporito, who came from Caltanissetta in the center of Sicily, was a butcher by profession, and I spent my summers with her when she emigrated to Rochester, New York, and she opened a butcher shop.
Oh, isn't this unusual?
Yeah, it was very unusual. I still have her cleaver. I have her cleaver in the drawer in my kitchen where whenever I look at it, and it has a big chestnut handle and this big, huge blade, I think of, I can still hear her whacking those chickens.
Wow.
And Nona Galasso, my mother's mother, had eight children, and her husband, my grandfather Carmen, was tragically killed when he was about 48 years old.
Oh, wow.
And so here was a woman who was faced with what did she do with eight children. Well, what she does is that she starts a boarding house, and in this boarding house in her neighborhood, she had the only bathtub. My father would tell me these stories. This is why they're in the book, because I remember all of these things. So what she did was she put a sign outside that said bath and a meal, 25 cents. You had to bring your own towel, though. And she had lines waiting for, and this is how she survived, by cooking for people and by providing the only bathtub that was in her neck of the neighborhood.
Marianne, when did these ladies come to the United States? Were they born in Naples and Sicily, respectively?
Yes. Yes, they were born in Naples and Sicily, respectively, and actually they came around 1900.
And
that
your
time.
One was arranged marriage, right?
Yes, my grandmother, Saporito, actually was married while she was in Sicily, but then her first husband died, and then her second husband, who was my grandfather, Rosario. That was an arranged marriage. She actually, I didn't go into this in the book, but when she arrived in Fairport, New York, which is just outside of Rochester, she actually started adopting children, and she had two adopted children along with her own that she raised, and one who tragically died in a fire. So these women, they gave of their physical energy and their emotional energy, and they have always been my role models, and I just felt that it was time to give them a little praise.
Well, you know, as I said, these women are just absolutely extraordinary, and you got to learn a lot along the way from their cooking. Now, do you think, I mean, you don't specialize in just Neapolitan and Sicilian cooking in this book. I do regional Italian all across the board, right?
Yes, I do, because one of the first things I said in my television show was that there was no such thing as Italian cooking. There's only regional cooking. And even though this book weighs heavy on what Nona Saporito and Galasso did,
yeah,
I also weave the stories of my involvement with Italian regional cooking as I have seen it and as I've experienced it, not only through them, but also in my travels to Italy. So there are lots of recipes in here that are go beyond the southern dishes, if you will.
Would you call the recipes in this book authentic Italian or Italian-American? We just interviewed Lydia Bastianich again about her Lydia of Italy and America with the Italian-American cooking.
Well, my answer to that is that they are both.
Yeah.
Because if you say, are they authentic Italian recipes, the answer has to be no, because you will never recreate the flavors of Italy as they exist in Italy. But you can come close to approximating the flavors by using the best Italian ingredients that are available to you in this country. We live here. We do not live in Italy. And so every Italian cookbook, not just mine, is an approximation of the flavors that you would find in Italy. They are not, you cannot say that they are the true authentic because the meat is different, the fish is different. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
The tomatoes are different.
Exactly. But these recipes do follow the guidelines of what authentic Italian cooking would be.
And the whole dining experience. You emphasize the family experience in this cookbook, which is something that we've all begun to start paying attention to again.
Absolutely. This is quintessential Italian, is that when you enjoy a meal, you enjoy it as a family, as a unit. You don't eat in front of the television set. You don't eat in your car. You don't eat rushing from one thing to the next. You sit down, and food becomes then communication. Food is a healer. Food is a way of connecting people, and that has always been true for the Italian family. La Famiglia is everything, and everything around the table.
Now, the title we haven't even mentioned is a follows the title of your show, Ciao Italia, Family Classics, more than 200 treasured recipes from three generations of Italian cooks. That pretty much sums it up.
Yep.
How do you organize something like that? I mean, I know because I've read the book, but tell our audience.
Well, I organized the book from what you would begin a meal with, antipasto, to what you would end a meal with occasionally, which would be desserts, because you can't really write a cookbook today without including a dessert chapter. Although desserts, as I tell you, are things that are, you know, they're relegated for special occasions. They're not something that Italians eat every day. But
yeah, no, we didn't either.
Right, but we write cookbooks here for an American audience.
Right. And you do have a great cannoli recipe in there.
Oh, well, yeah, Nonna Saporito's cannoli recipe. But so I take the reader from antipasto all the way on to dessert. In each chapter, I try to give a story-type introduction to why I'm including these recipes in the book. And I hope that readers find that the book does read like a good story and that it's just not a compilation of a pinch of this and two tablespoons of that, but there's a why for the name of the recipe, and there's a reason why I chose this particular recipe. I really had to think hard about which recipes I wanted to include in this book, because, as you said earlier, how is this book different when I have 11 other previous cookbooks? Well, all of those other 11 previous cookbooks took a different turn. Some of them are specific to a particular region of Italy, like Ciao Italia in Tuscany or Ciao Italia in Umbria. Some of them were written for the cook who is in a hurry, like Ciao Italia Pronto. And then there's Ciao Italia Slow and Easy, which was written for those people who like to take it slow in the kitchen instead of fast. So I tried to find a different angle because the subject of Italian food in itself, regional Italian food, is vast. And we've really just begun to scratch the surface, really, and how Italian food has changed today in Italy and how it is adapted differently for a new generation of cooks in Italy is also very important. So
yeah, we encountered that even in Sicily, which is, I would say, the more conservative, one of the most conservative regions in
yeah, things,
Italy.
Things change more slowly.
In Sicily.
And they modern is probably 20 years behind when things happen in the rest of Italy, if not longer.
But we found a lot of new cuisine. New meaning, well, how do you define modern? I mean, modern,
well,
lighter, and you know.
Right, yes. But, and I think that you'll find that today there's a, what I see in Italy from having traveled over the last 25 years, in Italy, is that what is happening here in our own country in terms of the food culture is also happening in Italy. The younger generation does not know their food culture. I'll give you a perfect example. Just recently when I was in Perugia, I took a group to Umbria, I went into Bavicchi, which is a seed store, because the garden that you see on my show is my home garden, and it's maintained by my husband, Guy, who is a physician, but he's also a passionate gardener. So every year I give him his marching orders about what will be featured in the garden for the Ciao Italia segment that I'm going to do. So I wanted to find zuppa gialla seeds. Zuppa gialla, you know, just a yellow pumpkin that is used for fillings for tortellini.
Oh, is that a separate? I didn't even know it was a separate breed. Okay.
Yeah, and so I went into Bevicki, and a woman, I would say she was maybe 45 or so, I asked for these seeds, and she directed me to where they were. I picked up the packet, and then she said to me, well, what are you going to do with those? And I told her, I said, I was going to make tortelli, di zucca gialla. And her next question was, how do you do that?
Oh, dear.
Now, that astounded me, because I should have been asking her that question. This is your food culture. Mm-hmm. You should know.
But isn't it the same? You mentioned it's the same as it's happening here.
Absolutely.
People have less and less time. Less and less families prepare a meal every day. We do that for the two of us every day, just because that's our tradition and it's the way we were raised, and we haven't changed.
Exactly.
Our son and daughter-in-law, I think, the only time they put a full meal, as we would call it, on the table is when we're visiting, and we help them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same thing is happening in Italy. We had a conversation with someone who's on the show a little bit ago about the trend towards people going to the pasticceria in their village to buy pasta for dinner.
Oh, sure.
Instead of fixing it for themselves, and it comes down to the fact that people's lives have gotten that much more frenetic, that much busier. There are so many more things to do with your time. That's certainly an American phenomenon, and increasingly it seems to be an Italian one as well.
Yeah, but Marianne points out in this book, I don't remember where, that they document that adults in the United States spend 4 hours a day watching TV.
Exactly.
And why wouldn't that use that same 4 hours in the kitchen?
You and I agree. I mean, that's why we don't know any of the TV shows that are on the current schedule, because we don't listen. But I have a question, because the garden is clearly a very important topic for you, and you mentioned that guy who's a physician is responsible for the garden. I don't know what I do for a living, but I am responsible for the garden as well. What I want to know is, where did he get the dead man to bury in the garden?
Well, see, this is great, because you did your homework. Every garden needs a dead man. That's exactly right.
Now, I initially thought that meant they needed a dead person to fertilize the garden. But I think you'd better go on to explain.
When God puts in the garden, he usually has the fellow who is on the grounds here, who does the other stuff, help him. And he is an Italian. His name is Marino. And one day when they were up in the garden, the zucchini had gotten away from Guy, so that now we had these baseball bats, which, you know, there was nothing much that we could do but put on the compost heap. And Marino just looked at Guy, and he says, Gaetano, he says, every garden needs a dead man. Which meant that, you know, if you have somebody in the garden to watch over things, maybe they wouldn't get out of hand so much. I thought it was fertilizer, too.
Exactly.
That's not exactly what he meant, you know. But the fresh produce is just so intricate to really good Italian cuisine. And just to say that, you know, one of the reasons that what's happening in Italy with the younger generation not cooking is because we now have the supermercati there.
Mm-hmm.
You never had the supermercati years ago. You would go to the individual store. You'd go to the bread store. You'd go to the fish market. You'd go to the macelleria to get your pork. Now we have these huge supermarkets called supermercati, even in Italy, and everything is under one roof. This is sad, and you have packaged food where before everything was fresh, where Italians realized things did not come on plastic trays with plastic wrap.
How about garlic in a jar in Italy?
Right. I mean, that's pretty sad, too. But when you go to the smaller towns, you still have that wonderful experience of the locals knowing their food. And I recall one day when I was in Cortona,
We
were staying there for a while, and so I went down to the market to buy some pears. Now, you know, if you go into the supermarket here, the pears are lined up. You get a pear, you get your pears, and you check out. Not in Italy, not in Cortona. I went up, and, of course, you don't touch the fruit. They'll pick it out for you. Mm-hmm. So the signora says to me, what are you going to do with the pears? So then I started explaining to her, and she said, well, this pear is too hard for that, but this pear over here would be perfect. And what I would do is I would take this pear and I would sit, let it sit on the counter for 2 days, and then the flavor will be better. Well, she went into this wonderful discussion about pears. Uh-huh. Now, when was the last time you were in the checkout lane at the grocery store and somebody asked you about what you were buying? They hardly know what you're buying because oftentimes they'll ask you, well, is this fennel or is what is this?
Oh, I know.
They don't even know.
They don't even recognize fennel, I know.
But that's the beauty of the smaller areas of Italy, is that you still have this connection to the land and the reverence for food. And that's what we don't have.
Well, this is what your book has, and I think that anybody who wants to make a study out of this and eat some delicious foods should check out your recipes here. I mean, I think the book is worth buying just for your artichoke recipes.
Thank you.
Oh, and
well, I like Nonna, who had a quick eye for wild cardoon in the hedgerows.
Yes. You know, and the cardoons is you don't see recipes like this.
No, you know what? They had them in our farmer's market. We have an all-natural farmer's market here. They had the cardoons, and I didn't get them. But everybody who got them, nobody knew how to cook them.
Right.
And they didn't look like real cardoon anyway.
No, it was like, what was the other thing that they gave me to try, and it was not the right thing.
It was the puntarelle.
Oh, the puntarelle.
Oh, the puntarelle.
But
yeah,
it's not the same.
But wouldn't you know, we were in this sort of dive cafeteria,
mm-hmm.
just outside Agrigento,
mm-hmm.
We it's really curious. We went to the sandwich shop first, but the sandwich shop didn't have a toilet, and that was one of the things we needed with our stop. So he said you have to go to this other restaurant.
It's a self-serve.
I think our bill was 18 euros for two people. one of the vegetables was cardoon, absolutely legitimate cardoon, the kind that really does taste like artichoke hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was the first time Peter had ever, he said, finally, your mother was absolutely right. Cardoon really does taste like artichoke.
Yeah, when she grew it, it didn't really work out that well. So,
yeah.
So here's the deal, listeners, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think the key thing here, the right way to use this book is to find whatever Italian-oriented ingredient you can that's the freshest and the best out of your garden or somebody else's or a farmer's market. Then you go to the index. You get home and go to the index and find out what you can cook that in. and then you're all set to know what you're having for dinner.
Yeah. That's right.
Dear. Well, you're always a delight, Marianne, and keep up the good work. Are you working on cookbook number 13?
Not yet, but I'm thinking about it.
She's jumping to 14.
She's jumping to 14.
Okay. I like to give my cookbook some breathing space, so.
Uh-huh.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It was it's not only a great contribution to cooking literature, it was also great fun talking to you.
Well, it was wonderful talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Marianne.
All right, bye-bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back once again. And if you thought it couldn't get any better, let me tell you it can, because our next guest, Francine Segan, has gone right to the heart of what's irresistible about Italian cuisine. It's desserts. It's sweet.
But it's the only way we could get you to listen to the program so far was to put it on the end, just like you get your dolce if you're in Italia. So here we go.
Francine Segan, is it?
Segan.
And that must be your married name, because you are 100% Italian blood.
Yes, my maiden name was Cristallo.
Oh, that's nice. And you picked up probably one of the most attractive aspects of Italian cuisine. You wrote a book called Dolci, which is Italy's sweets. So you must have had a lot of fun researching this book.
It was the highlight of my time in Italy, to get a chance to meet all these wonderful home cooks and great food bloggers and just wonderful foodies throughout Italy who wanted to share all their family secrets.
Yes, now you are a food historian as well as a cookbook author. I guess the Opera Lovers Cookbook was a smash hit that you wrote too. You win awards for your books. You do television. I don't even know how you managed to get around doing all this stuff. This book was a little bit of variation of your usual approach to cookbook writing. Tell us how you got all these recipes, and they're not yours, are they?
No, in fact, the very first sentence of the opening, I say none of the recipes are mine. I wanted this to be not a takeoff on what we think of as Italian recipes, but really contemporary Italian recipes. I wanted to understand what Italians were making today, both grandmas and, you know, young women. What were they really eating? Especially what desserts didn't we know about here in the States? And so I went about that by reaching out to friends, asking them to find the person in their town that was known for the best cookie or the best cake. I reached out to bloggers. Italy has some wonderful foodies who spend time sharing their recipes and travels and thoughts on the internet, and as well as chefs, professionals.
Huh. Well, I mean, you have some wonderful, wonderful recipes in here. I was looking at the grape jam recipe, and it occurred to me this is probably what my relatives were referring to when they called for in their cucinada a jar of grape jam.
I think so. The thing that I loved was how little sugar the Italians put in things. When we think of jam, we think of the weight of the fruit in sugar. And I was so surprised when so many home cooks showed me their wonderful pantries filled with these glistening jars of jams and jellies, and then shared that they don't do anything but very slow simmer them with no additional sugar. And just for the, instead of pectin, they just sometimes put an apple, and that gels it up and
wonderful.
Really tastes the fruit.
Now, like this, you said, sure, it's true because you said it, you wrote it, that there are more master chocolatiers in Italy than in both France and Belgium combined, and further, that the Italians are the only ones that resisted the EU in terms of being able to add other fats into chocolate, that it's absolutely 100% pure cocoa butter. Is that all true?
I'm glad that you noticed that. I was very proud of the Italians that when I learned that the EU, the European Union, allowed up to 5% of non-cocoa butter fats to be used in chocolate and still be called chocolate. Otherwise, it would be called a chocolate-like product. But the Italians, because they so respect ingredients and they don't like additives and they don't like changing and mucking around, they decided to say, no, thank you. Their chocolate, all Italian chocolate, is 100% chocolate, cocoa butter. No fats, no tropical oils, no other fats.
Well, you know, we were interviewing this woman who lives and works out of Sicily. She said that the EU really comes down hard on a lot of the techniques that artisanal producers in Italy use, including chocolate makers.
Well, I think that, you know, everything comes down to business, and I think that sometimes when you have one country who just wants to stick to clean ingredients and clean, simple artisanal techniques, that maybe there's some fuss. But what I loved was discovering all the wonderful chocolates and all the wonderful chocolate desserts that are throughout Italy, starting with Piedmont, which was, I think, a hub of chocolate in Italy. I discovered when researching Dolce that Piedmont was the gate that opened to allow chocolate through Italy, because that was the richest region. That region was one of the first after Spain to get chocolate.
Of course, it came from the New World.
Yes, Columbus discovered it as he discovered the New World. He was the first European.
He was Italian anyway.
He was Italian. Even though he was sailing for Spain, he was the first European to set eyes on cocoa beans and brought the first batch over to Europe. And when it was interesting, when cocoa beans came into Italy, the Italians looked at them and realized correctly that they were seeds. You use cocoa beans to plant to make a cocoa tree. And so just like seeds, like fennel and cumin and coriander, they're a spice. They can be toasted, then ground and put on other ingredients, mixed into stews with venison or rabbit, put on top of polenta. So there are lots of savory chocolate recipes that are Italian.
Well, of course, now, you tackle another aspect, an inverse of that, which I mean, I thought I knew about Italian desserts, cookies and tiramisu and whatever. Never, ever have I come anywhere near something called chocolate eggplant.
I wanted, one of the things that I thought was such fun was to share with the American audience some of the recipes that were very traditional in a particular region, but not so known in other regions. So when I discovered that there was an extremely popular dessert called chocolate eggplant that is throughout the Amalfi Coast by Sorrento, Ravello, even up into Naples, that whole area, I had to go there and see for myself. And the height of the season when you enjoy that dessert is August. And the eggplant is either grilled or fried and then layered like lasagna with a sweet ricotta and a chocolate sauce. And it's put in the fridge, gets icy cold, and then it's cut into little squares. And it is delicious because the eggplant is kind of a neutral canvas for just the wonderful chocolate and ricotta.
You have a lot of desserts with radicchio, and you have desserts with different forms of pasta. I mean, I never encountered any of that.
I had fun playing with some recipes that I felt, again, we didn't know here. And so I included an entire chapter called Weird and Wonderful, including what I learned was that there are many, many regions that have pasta for dessert, both from as far south as Sicily to as far north as the Veneto. In Sicily, they have a lovely little tiny morsel of a fried pasta that's coated with honey that's so simple to make and yet so sophisticated. It's crunchy and chewy. In Emilia, Romagna, they have several kinds of pasta desserts. Emilia is known for its wonderful egg pasta, and they make a fabulous pie. It's called curly pasta pie, torta ricciolina. You use angel hair pasta and just toss it with cocoa powder and crushed nuts and put it, bake it into a pie crust. And what happens when it bakes, the raw egg pasta just absorbs all the chocolate and cooks, but stays a little crunchy so that you have a wonderful combination of creamy and crunchy textures.
Next chance I have, I'm going to look for them. When
Or it's so simple to make, you can make it.
Oh, wow.
Just a few ingredients. Just even if you don't want to make your own pasta, just store-bought pasta. And I bet you, in your pantry, you've got all the other ingredients already.
How about, talk to us about semifreddo. You have a lot of those.
I fell in love with how easy it is to make frozen treat. I had several home cooks show me that even before there were such things as ice cream makers, and I've played around with ice cream makers, and so I didn't have too much success, but I love the semifreddo, which is creaminess of an ice cream, but without the ice cream maker.
Uh-huh.
And I liked that there are basically, you just need four ingredients to make a good semifreddo, and then you can kind of tweak it to have whatever signature you want. You can add torrone, that wonderful Italian nougat, or panforte, which is something that's available right now at the holiday time.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting story, that you say that the sugar wafers are actually packaged in little circles and sold in pharmacies.
Yes,
as a palliative for the medicine.
I loved that. When I went to really go to the sources and have people show me, it was fun standing in their kitchens, and then the stories unfolded. So panforte is a mixture of honey and about six or seven kinds of dried fruit and six or seven nuts, and then it's baked, and they bake it on a kind of sugar wafer just to kind of keep its form and to hold it together, and it's topped with powdered sugar. But that sugar wafer, you can buy it in a pastry shop, so it's large enough for the cake, but it's also sold in drugstores, these little circular, flat, very thin sugar wafers that people in Italy like to wrap around pills to make them easier to swallow, to chew.
That's so amazing.
Is that how you get your kids to take their pills?
Okay. Well, the other thing that I was totally fascinated with was your chocolate salami.
That's fun. Something from Sicily in the south of Italy. It's kind of like one gigantic truffle.
It looks Instead like of, the salami.
It does. It's that. I think that the idea of making food look like something else is something that dates to the Renaissance, when they used to have guests come to wonderful feasts, they wanted to surprise them, enchant them with the foods they were presented. And so they would sculpt food. They would make meatballs into the shape of pears and put a little herb at the top to look like the leaf of a pear. Or they would take marzipan and shape it into the shape of fruit or vegetables, which is still very popular in Sicily.
Oh, yeah.
And so this tradition of making something look like something else was really a surprise at banquets, something that at each course they would present. And so this recipe, that style of surprising your guests, continues in Italy. They love to make things in different shapes. And this chocolate salami is really just a gigantic truffle. So chocolate mixed with some crushed cookies and nuts, then made into a log and then coated with powdered sugar. And when it cools and solidifies in the fridge and you serve it and take it out, it looks just like a salami. And you can even add a little twine so that you really finish the faux look.
Well, there you go. So you really are making it look
it
like
is. It,
like
it does look like a salami. Well, we've been talking about some of the more unusual desserts in here, but I should mention that you have many of the traditional classic ones too, like the torta della nonna and the tiramisu, which I was really surprised to find out was invented in 1960.
I know it becomes probably the most popular dessert throughout Italy, throughout the world as far as Italian desserts. My editor for Dolce Italy Sweets asked me when I was researching, she said, you know, since you're going to speak to so many Italian chefs and Italians, might as well get the definitive best panna cotta recipe, the best cannoli recipe. Get some of the classics and try to find the best. And so I asked chefs themselves, who would they recommend in Italy to teach me to make the best? And so, for example, for the best panna cotta, I went to Piedmont, which is where the region where panna cotta was first created. For the best cannoli, I went to Sicily, where, of course, cannoli was invented. And so I do. I have some of the classic traditional dishes, but tried by seeking them out and testing several and actually asking Italians for their advice. I hope I got the very best, easiest, and most wonderful example.
Well, you made me feel not guilty about the cannoli when you say that not everybody makes the shells themselves, because I have those, the aluminum tubes, and I've never made a shell ever in my whole entire life.
Well, it's actually easy if you have even a pasta maker, you know, to just kind of try it one more time. What they say in Italy is that fried like children, they get better the more you make.
Yeah.
I don't know whether either one of those is necessarily true.
So, but anyhow, I should mention, as we're talking about this, that you also wrap up the book with wines, dessert wines and liqueurs, different coffees to make. Also, you can make your own limoncello if you like limoncello, and cover all bases.
I wanted to try to give us here in America a real taste of La Dolce Vita. A little bit of what I see when I'm in Italy is this kind of three-course wave of dessert. They serve you the dessert, never with espresso. The espresso always comes last. And then that's served with dessert wine. So that, like the classic Cantucci cookies that you dip in Vin Santo.
Right.
But there are lots of other wonderful liqueurs. And then there's coffee that's served, and the coffee can be spiked or not, or then they have riffs on coffee and drinks that go with espresso. And then there's the after dinner, the digestivo, something to help your digestion, or something like a grappa. And I loved how people in Italy kind of personalize their spirits, too. They sort of take a neutral liquor like, you know, grain alcohol or even vodka, and then can make their own coffee liqueur or berry liqueur. And they were so delicious.
Well, it's a delicious book, and I wish you a lot of luck with this. And are you officially on your book tour now?
I am. I am very much enjoying sharing the recipes with different audiences. This weekend I was at the New York Chocolate Show.
Oh, yes.
In Manhattan, where I did two chocolate pasta desserts, one that is very traditional for Christmas Eve. It's just dry pasta, cooked boiled pasta that's then tossed with chocolate and walnuts and a little splash of rum, orange zest, and if you like cinnamon or nutmeg. And it's just the easiest thing and the most homey and delicious end to a meal.
Well,
Italy is about hospitality. I guess dessert is about, dolce is about hospitality too. So on my birthday, which happened one day we were in Sicily, the hotel we were staying at, the kitchen found out and they made me a cake. Now that's hospitality.
Oh, aren't the Italians? I even have a little paragraph in my book on hospitality, on how a town just rolled out the red carpet to share the town's famous recipes with me. People open their homes in Italy. It's an amazing country and amazing treatment of food and appreciation for how much happens at the table and how important that time spent together at the table is.
And this book comes with its own diet plan.
Yes, actually. You'll be very pleased to know that I actually lost weight during the 1 year of working on the book because Italian sweets just do not have that much sugar, and they have a richness and very satisfying, and the portions are just perfect to make you feel like you've indulged, not too much.
And I'll buy the bridge you have for sale, too.
Francine, nice meeting you and talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's all from us. Until next week, same time, same place. We'll look forward to seeing you then.
Bye-bye.